For more than 30 years, Graham Downey was one of Australia's most respected journalists. Graham is totally blind, but he was determined that would not define his career. Instead, it was his writing in the Canberra Times that won him several awards. He covered religion and interviewed most of Australia's faith leaders. He's released a new book, Servants and Leaders, Eminent Christians in Their Own Words. Graham Downey joined me to discuss some of his subjects, beginning with the complex figure of Peter Hollingworth, Anglican bishop turned Governor-General.
I knew Peter Hollingworth in the early 1980s when he was with the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence. I met him at the National Press Club once or twice, and I wouldn't say we were close friends, but we certainly developed a good relationship when he was criticising Bob Hawke and his government because he didn't think the government was supporting the poor, who Hollingworth worked for.
Yeah, he was criticising a Labor government from the left.
Yes, yes.
And what did Bob Hawke say, by the way?
You'll have to remind me because you have the book and I don't. But he said something like he shouldn't interfere or he should stick to his pulpit, didn't he?
I think he said something even more Bob Hawke-like. He said Peter Hollingworth was bloody unchristian.
I suppose that says more about Bob Hawke and his understanding of Christianity, because there are many Christians, and Peter Hollingworth is one of them, who believes that one must speak up for people who need that sort of support.
But how did Peter Hollingworth change when he left the Brotherhood in the late 1980s to become the Anglican Archbishop of Brisbane?
I think he changed because he became the Archbishop of Brisbane, because he had once criticised the establishment. And when he went to Brisbane, he became part of the establishment. And I think that's what changed him significantly. I interviewed Peter Hollingworth in Brisbane for the National Library for their oral history unit. And I came across Peter Hollingworth as a complex, as you say, person, but also two very different people. At a personal level to myself, and I mentioned this in the book, he carried my equipment back to the hotel for me when I finished doing the interview. Yet, I remember he was concerned that he wasn't accepted, wasn't given the due deference to an archbishop in Brisbane.
Yes. You make a point at the end of the chapter about Peter Hollingworth that I found quite moving and hard to understand. You said, "I was surprised at the importance he seemed to place on one's social position. It was not what I had expected from a social campaigner."
He did take his social position very seriously. Just a quick example, he said, "Sometimes they invite me to functions and don't even invite my wife." Mm. He saw that that was the sort of social standard that should have applied.
And yet he reached the top, as it were, of Australia's government as Governor-General, the Queen's representative. Interesting, because he'd actually evinced some sympathy for a republic. What brought Peter Hollingworth undone?
What I wrote in the book, and in fact I wrote it for the Canberra Times long before that, was that when Peter Hollingworth went to Brisbane, there was a time bomb ticking and he couldn't defuse it. Words to that effect. And that was the scandal of sexual abuse within a couple of schools. There was one where one of the staff had abused about 80 of the students at the school. That had occurred long before Peter Hollingworth went to Brisbane. Then there was the case of Bishop Don Shearman, who many years ago had a sexual encounter with a young woman, a student that he was responsible for. And as Archbishop of Brisbane, Peter Hollingworth rather excused what Don Shearman had done and said rather than Don Shearman having instigated it was rather the young woman who had.
Yes, he'd made some errors of judgment, and they were pretty lethal errors of judgment.
I felt, still do, feel very sorry for Peter Hollingworth, because I think his decision to accept the Governor-Generalship was wrong for him. I don't mean that a clergyman shouldn't be Governor-General. I don't much, frankly, care who Governor-General is. But I think it was a wrong decision for him, because it came on top of the controversy in the Archdiocese of Brisbane, And I think had he had the vision of foresight, he would have recognised that there was going to be public controversy over himself.
Yeah. Let's talk about Joy Bartholomew. She's a long-time Presbyterian minister in Canberra. Why was this woman, born in Khartoum in the Sudan, the daughter of missionaries, really a complete outlier in her church?
Well, I think it's fair to say Joy Bartholomew's name is not known very well outside Canberra and the places in New South Wales where she served. Joy was called to the ministry at a time when the Presbyterian Church of Australia accepted women as a clergy. She was also at the time when perhaps she could have joined the Uniting Church, where in many ways her gender, in every way, her gender wouldn't have mattered at all.
No, and it may have helped because the Uniting Church has had many women leaders.
I remember interviewing Anglican women when they couldn't be ordained in the Anglican Church. And the simple question is, well, then why don't you join the Uniting Church? And their response was, because it's not my church. Mm. And it was the same for Joy Bartholomew, yeah. That the Presbyterian Church was her church. And she felt called and was called to the ministry in the Presbyterian Church. And for some time, that caused her and the church no difficulty. But as you know very well, the Presbyterian Church, when it lost the more, you might say, progressive members when they joined the Uniting Church, the Presbyterian Church became more conservative, and later still became even more conservative when it was infiltrated by very conservative evangelicals, particularly in Sydney.
Yeah, I mean, 1967, the Presbyterians say a resounding yes to women elders and lay leaders. 40 years later, they've completely reversed that. So I suppose the enduring contradiction with someone like Joy is, why does she stick with a church which she says in your book she felt hurt and that the church did not take advantage of the gifts of women? So why did she stick with it?
You'd have to ask her, but I suspect one of the reasons was that she was in a parish which strongly supported her. Mm. She came to St. Andrew's in Canberra, which in 1977 was the only Presbyterian church in Canberra or Queanbeyan to remain in the Presbyterian Church. All of the others joined the Uniting Church. So it was a strongly Presbyterian church, but it had shown since that it chose clergy who were far more flexible in their thinking and their theology than some who made decisions in the Presbyterian Church.
It's the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West. I'm speaking with Graham Downey, a longtime Australian journalist, celebrated Australian journalist, about Graham's new book, Servants and Leaders, Eminent Christians in Their Own Words. I don't want to spend too much time on the next leader, but of course we can't avoid discussing him, George Pell. Why is Cardinal Pell, in your words, quote, not a favourite priest in his church? That's in his own church.
Yeah, I think because he is dogmatic and tries to represent his church as he sees it. And I think that's deserving of respect. But you have to remember that the clergy of the Catholic Church did not elect him as chairman of the Australian Bishops' Conference. The clergy of his church did not support his position in one of the conclaves they had at the Vatican. He wasn't a representative of the majority of his clergy even.
Yeah.
And I think that answers the question, that he was just seen as not in touch with today's Catholics or even today's church.
Yeah. I've got to say, Graham, you write about George Pell with more balance than anyone that I have ever read. So where is George Pell deserving of defence and where does he deserve criticism?
I find it hard to criticise people because of the beliefs they honestly hold, but I felt that whenever George Pell tried to be sympathetic, he didn't seem as though he was. Now, that's a perception and it might be unfair, but in my first interview with him, and I raised the question of people who were divorced and asked him why they should be excluded from the church's sacrament. And he quite sternly said, because that's the rules. And we can't manage the church well by simplifying its rules. That's paraphrasing, but that was the approach he took. Whereas now, even today's Pope recognises that the church has been unsympathetic and unkind to divorced people and potentially even to gay people.
Mm-hmm. Mark Coleridge, the Catholic Archbishop of Brisbane, very much seen as the coming man, he comes across initially as a very savvy, very down-to-earth kind of prelate. I always sort of describe him as a sort of knockabout footy coach. He loves using sort of colloquial language. Is he the sort of man who would be a good national leader of the church? Maybe his name's floated as a Archbishop of Melbourne.
He's very articulate. When he first came as Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn, he was self-deprecating. He admitted he didn't know much about Canberra and even less about the surrounding rural areas. He was, I think, never very popular in the rural areas around Canberra. The parishioners felt that he talked down to them.
I think he says, I was a mouth from the south.
You could ask Mark Coleridge a question and you would get an answer which could go on for 3 or 4 minutes quite easily. And much of that would be easily quotable.
Yeah.
The difficulty with Mark Coleridge was when he faced a criticism over a judgment that he made. And in my case, he never forgave me for reporting on it.
Yeah, well, that's the punchline. Why did you fall out with Mark Coleridge when he was the Archbishop of Canberra-Goulburn?
Well, there were two issues, really. The first was, and this wasn't my work, it was somebody from The Australian pointed out that he, in effect, plagiarised a book review. I was sympathetic to that. He wrote it in a hurry. He said he'd read lots of material and so on.
Because, but, yes, I should say up until this point when I read on, I thought, geez, the worst thing that Coleridge has done on his rap sheet is to sort of use six sentences from a review of Terry Eagleton. And who wouldn't? Because Eagleton's brilliant. But,
yes,
but it developed into a much more acrimonious blue, didn't it?
I had a day off work and I got a phone call to say that a visiting priest was conducting a mission at the St. Christopher's Cathedral in Canberra, not at the cathedral itself, but in that parish, and that the visiting priest had said that the earthquake in Mexico was a result of God taking vengeance because of the country's abortion laws. I was asked if I would do something for the paper, and we phoned the parish. And I left a message for the Archbishop to say, you've invited this chap here. Is this the sort of thing you want your invitees to be saying? Mark Coleridge says he didn't get my message. We wrote the story for the next day. He was very unhappy with the story. I still have all the material which followed. To be perfectly frank, I think most of the heat poured on the fire afterwards came in correspondence between the Archbishop and Jack Waterford from the Canberra Times. Because Coleridge criticised me, what did he call me, a pseudo-modern Anglican or something, even though I'm not, but not Anglican, I mean, nor pseudo-modern.
There's nothing pseudo about you, Graham. You were always the real deal. But the point is, and we have to sort of move it along, you write here that even when I attempted to re-establish a working relationship, the Archbishop demonstrated, quote, a petulance not worthy of a senior church leader.
I invited him to have a cup of coffee with me. You would understand that journalists occasionally, with goodwill or otherwise, upset somebody. And I wasn't saying that what I'd done was perfect, and I thought it would be good just to have a chat and to overcome whatever difference there was. And even when he left Canberra, he refused to be interviewed by me.
Let's end on a very high note, someone I think that we both consider a hero, Desmond Tutu. Now, he seems to me to be blessedly uncomplicated. Should the Anglicans make him the first saint? Well, if not since the first Anglican saint, if not since the Reformation, then certainly in a few hundred years.
I think Desmond Tutu is not only a saint, but I was just thinking about him this morning. What I think is so special about Desmond Tutu is that he combines his spirituality, his Christianity, and his humanity in a way that so many of us can never do. That he confronted an evil in his country, and he also applied incredible humour and good nature and a cutting type of wit, which combined to make him, I believe, one of today's really significant human beings.
Servants and Leaders, Eminent Christians in Their Own Words. It's the new book by one of Australia's most eminent journalists, Graham Downey, formerly of the Canberra Times. Graham, really, it is a wonderful book with some terrific insights. Thank you very much for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you very much.